Back with you together on Thursday, April 22nd, 2021 on Connecticut Today. Luther Turmel joined us, a business reporter for Hearst Connecticut Media in Connecticut, of course, covering the Connecticut Post, the New Haven Register, and other newspapers. Luther has been following an interesting standoff between the governor teamed up with Attorney General William Tong against PURA, the Public Utilities Regulatory Authority, regarding a plan to hold off on rate increases from UI. So Luther tried to explain that to us. 4 o'clock hour, we started off with the latest from Governor Ned Lamont on the coronavirus situation in the state. And Leanne Duquette joined us from Informed Choices CT in the 5 o'clock hour about the recent defeat of her group's efforts to maintain the religious vaccine exemption on the state and what she feels may happen going forward with the state Senate and also with some legal challenges. There's a really interesting story going on right now. And in reading it, the common person would say, well, wait a minute, what's the elephant in the room here? It's a story that involves the governor's office, the attorney general's office, the UI company, which, of course, serves a lot of the southern Connecticut area, about 390,000 customers, including Greater Bridgeport, New Haven, and PURA, the Public Utility Regulatory Authority. And he's been covering this and utilities for years on the business end for Hearst Connecticut Media. Luther Turmel, my old college buddy, back on the show. Luther, how are you, buddy?
Pretty good, Paul. How are you?
I'm good. And Luther, you know, I started to read your story the other day, and it was, you were trying to, you know, I hate to use the term dumb down, but explain a pretty complicated situation here. And maybe it's me, maybe I'm too dumb to understand it, but it's not often, Luther, you see the governor and the attorney general in the state agreeing that a state regulatory agency is wrong and then, or claiming they're wrong, and the utility saying something else. What is actually going on here?
Well, I mean, I think that the frustration, Paul, is that their PURA's actions made the attorney general and the governor of the state of Connecticut, Ned Lamont, look bad. They negotiated this deal with United Illuminating that would stabilize rates in the short term and keep UI from going out for a rate increase. I just need to go look at my story here, but I mean, it was at least for a couple of years that this was going to delay their ability to file for a rate increase. And lo and behold, PURA turns around and rejects the deal in favor of what the attorney general's office, the governor's office, and also the Office of Consumer Counsel, which represents ratepayers in rate proceedings, have all said is like a pittance in the short term. And so I think, you know, there's a lot of feeling of political brinksmanship that here it was that they negotiated this deal, United Illuminating was willing to do it, and all of a sudden PURA turns around and says, not so fast.
Now, what, and Luther, I know I haven't read any follow-up to this, forgive me if you did one, but I know in the story that you did do, and as other news agencies cited as well, PURA didn't comment directly, did they not, on why they said no to this? Have they added anything further on that or not?
No, they have not, and typically, as I said in the story that you mentioned last week, you know, it's not, because they're a quasi-judicial body, they normally don't comment on decisions that are draft decisions because there's still a possibility that they could be changed. Whether this one will be or not, I don't know. But if it turns out to go back to the way the original plan, you know, it's going to be an example of influence that the governor and other state political leaders can wield on PURA. And the irony here is, Paul, that, you know, this idea that the current chair of the of PURA, Melissa Gillette, was brought in a couple years ago. And the conventional wisdom, the storyline that's come out is, you know, that, you know, she's the new sheriff in town and things are going to be different than they were in the past. And maybe this is an example of PURA trying to trying to prove that. The problem is that this was a pretty good deal for ratepayers, and, you know, based on what I know, and short of an explanation by PURA, which could come after the final decision is issued, you know, short of an explanation of that, it really, I'm dumbfounded as to why they would do this.
Interesting. Luther, hang on. Yeah, I want to get back into the mechanics of this deal straight ahead. We'll just take a break. Luther Turmel is with us, business reporter. He covers the energy sector as well for the Hearst, Connecticut media papers, New Haven Register, Connecticut Post, Stamford Advocate, Norwalk Hour, and all of that. More on this kind of head-scratcher with PURA straight ahead. First, traffic and weather together on WICC. And if you are a customer of the United Illuminating Company, UI, you may be talking about a story that our guest here wrote a few days ago, Hearst, Connecticut media business reporter Luther Turmel, regarding the state public utilities regulatory authorities saying no to a deal that the attorney general wanted, the governor wanted, and the UI company wanted to forestall rate increases for a couple of years. Continuing with Luther, the original deal, why was this done? Was it just to be nice to UI ratepayers during the pandemic, or in light of what happened with the storms? What was the reason for the delay?
Well, nothing in corporate America is done to be nice. I mean, there's a trade-off, and you know, it's my understanding that that it helped. How it helped UI, what it did for UI, was that it got some debt off the books that, you know, that because between the $5 million that they kicked in, you know, as part of the rate stabilization issue and, mm-hmm. and some of the other factors that were part of the original deal, that it enabled UI to make its books a little bit cleaner, which in turn helps them by, you know, when they go out to, you know, raise funds for different projects. And, you know, when they go out to borrow money, they can get it at a cheaper rate. And, of course, that in turn turns around and helps consumers because, you know, if the company gets it at a cheaper rate, they don't have to charge as much. So, I mean, that's basically what UI, as I understand it, was getting out of this.
And you mentioned this, and I went to the Attorney General's website, too, and saw this myself. Attorney General William Tong, he did not hold back at all, Luther, on the statement his office put out at his dismay of this. He couldn't have worded that any more stronger if he tried.
Right. No, absolutely. And, I mean, I think, you know, here's the thing, you know, when the initial word of the deal came out, Tong used this as a victory lap that he and the governor could presumably take if PURA approved it, but he also used it to tweak Eversource Energy. When the press release came out, it was basically, you know, Tong said something to the effect of, well, you know, this is what happens when you have executives that you can work with who are concerned about consumers. And I'm paraphrasing here, but basically he said, you know, too bad you can't say the same thing for Eversource. It's embarrassing. It's egg on your face. Yeah. Nobody likes to be embarrassed.
Absolutely. You know, finally, Luther, you mentioned PURA before being this quasi judicial type of agency, and you've watched them for a while, and I'm not looking for a personal opinion here or not, Luther, but you say, you know, they have a new sheriff in town there with Katie Dykes and that, I'm sorry, Melissa, not Katie Dykes, the other person you mentioned, heading PURA.
Melissa Gillette.
Gillette, yes, thank you. I had the deep commissioner on the brain here. You know, Luther, I've talked over the years, on the air and off, with legislators from both sides of the aisle who have very frankly told me, look, PURA is not the, I guess, how could I say it? PURA is not this divine group of people who are not beyond influence. Is there still that controversy with Pura or not?
Well, I mean, I don't. I think that that's more lawmakers talking because it gets them, you know, headlines and then you know, gets them the airtime on the radio. I mean, look, I won't deny that Pura and its predecessor, the Department of Public Utilities Control, had a difficult situation because they're quasi-judicial. I think that ever since I came to work in Connecticut at the end of the 90s, that, you know, they're very careful because everything they say can be used when a company goes and turns around and sues, you know, to get the decision overturned. So I don't know that there's an undue influence from, you know, from the electric industry. I mean, you know, the people that are on there, I mean, at one point, Kevin Delgado, may he rest in peace, was on there. He was a state lawmaker.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's since passed away. But and he used the same thing about there's a new sheriff in town. Only the way that he used it was that, you know, he went to these third-party electric providers and said, you know, you got to play nice with the consumers, basically. And then, you know, the administration's changed and Dan Malloy became governor. And I mean, the only thing that's really political about Pura as an agency is that by and large, their membership changes, you know, based on who the sitting governor chooses to reappoint.
Mm-hmm.
Melissa Gillette was brought in a couple years ago. Michael Caron has been there for a couple years. The only guy that's been there for the entire time that I've been at the Register and with First Connecticut Media is Jack Betkowski. He's been there. He predates me, you know, coming to Connecticut. So anything prior to 1997. And, you know, they have a difficult job. There's no question about it.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I do think that if you're looking for, you know, I don't want to say shady, but a questionable arrangement, you know, you've got people that go from the utility companies in Connecticut to go to work for ISO New England, which is the operator of the electric grid for the 6-state region. And, you know, a lot of the charges that end up on our bills come from ISO New England. It's not to say they're entirely at fault, but I think there's a lot more. I'm a little less comfortable with people going directly from these electric companies to ISO New England just because they can have so much of an effect on what ratepayers pay, not only in Connecticut, but all of 6 states.
Those ever-popular distribution charges. Luther Termel, Hearst Connecticut Media business reporter. Read his stuff in the Connecticut Post, the New Haven Register, among others, including the Stanford Advocate, the Norwalk Hour. Luther, thank you. Good to talk to you again, and we will be in touch, my friend. Be good.
All right, take care, bye-bye.
Thanks. Luther Termel there. Check it out. So he said, you know, I guess, you know, Pura really hasn't said why they don't think it's a good idea that you folks who are on UI pay less for a couple of years. So, you know, we'll see if they say anything. Luther, thanks.
As we get into the COVID daily summary, this is Earth Day. And let's not forget that these 100-year storms, these 100-year pandemics may be impacted by what's going on with our climate. And so I thank all the people who take that climate initiative so seriously, as we do here in Connecticut. That said, where are we compared to yesterday? I think you see that we did a lot of testing, and I think you see that the positivity rate is low, low in the sense that it's at least below 2%, low in the sense that our 7-day moving average is 2.5%. That's probably the lowest it's been in a month and a half. So we feel like still we're on very stable footing there, and that gives us the confidence as we go forward. 8 more hospitalizations, 515 currently COVID-related hospitalizations. You know, Josh reminds me that exactly 1 year ago, was the day here in Connecticut we had our peak in terms of hospitalizations. That was a 1,972. Today we're at 515. I think that gives you an idea. We were losing in many days over 100 people a day. So I still continue to be confident that the vaccinations are making a difference, which takes us to vaccinations. And what you see here is a couple of things. 60% of our adults 16 and above have received their first dose. 51% have received their first and second dose. 51%. That's a big deal. You compare that to Georgia and Alabama and those states where it's 30% of the people have received have been fully vaccinated. Georgia, which is the home of Center for Disease Control, CDC, is about 33%. So thank you. We're making good progress, and you see it's making a difference on the infection rate and hospitalizations, fatalities. This is sort of interesting. The first dose rates by age, you can see 65 and above, we added 2%. We're at 89% of the people 65 and above. Jump on just a few more of you, and we'll get to 90%, which is absolute herd immunity. 55 to 64, they're up at about 76%, so really good progress there. And in the younger age groups, at least you can see that we're making a big increase over the last week. You know, 16 to 24, we're added 8%, 25 to 34, 7%. So we got to keep it going. We got to keep it going. And I say this in the context that supply is now more than demand in many places. You can often go right online and get an appointment. We're finding that many of our mobile vaccination vans that are out there, maybe they can do 140 doses in a day. Maybe they're doing 15 doses in a day. So we're going to talk a little bit out loud, and Chris and Dave are going to help me in terms of ways we can continue to incent people to get vaccinated. One thing is a reminder that it works. And I think you know that I often like the look abroad to get some indication of what the future may bring. And Israel is a good example, I think, where they are probably, a month and a half ahead of Connecticut and way ahead of Europe in terms of getting people vaccinated. These two lines here are sort of interesting. The blue line, which is going up, is the vaccination rate. And the yellow line is the cases, COVID-related infections per million. And I think you can see that as the COVID infections per million goes down, the vaccinations were going up. I should put that in the inverse. The more people vaccinated, the lower it's been. That purple line is when they got to 50% of the people vaccinated. And you can see at that point, the yellow cases per million line went way down. Hopefully, we're going to see something similar here in the state of Connecticut. We just passed 51% fully vaccinated. I was just looking at that blue line, and, you know, I spent 8 months saying it's really important we flatten the curve. Remember that phrase when it came to hospitalizations, infections? When it comes to vaccinations, you don't want to flatten that curve. And you can see that a place like Israel, which took the vaccinations so seriously, once they got to 50% vaccinated, it got a lot tougher to get the next group vaccinated. And you see that it took a month to get up to 60%. So keep that in mind as we try and give people all the reasons they need to get vaccinated. One thing we're doing with our volunteers, this is Volunteer Appreciation Week. Special thanks to the people of Connecticut. 6,000 of you have stepped up, over the last many months. You helped us with testings. You helped us with vaccinations. Helping us now with food distribution. Still real need there at the food distribution sites. Contact tracing. Some of those contact tracers are now knocking on doors and reminding people how important it is that they get vaccinated. Support in schools. You heard with Charlene the other day, we're getting our summer camps going, our summer learning camps, and we're going to need volunteers there. We're going to have a youth corps that we're paying as well to act as mentors for young people going forward. So appreciate your efforts there. The employer supports for vaccination. You maybe heard President Biden yesterday, I think it was, knowing that we got to work more with business and labor to give people the incentives, said to business, we're going to give you a tax credit. Any company with 500 employees or less, if they get vaccinated, give them the rest of the day off, and we'll give you a tax credit to pay for that. Those are some of the different types of incentives you're going to hear about here. On-site clinics. Chris will tell you about this. I can tell you that we're going at Electric Boat, one of our largest employers, next week, and making sure that they have all the vaccines they need to get vaccinated on-site. Free lunch, time off, gift cards, raffles. I was just told that Sacred Heart is doing a raffle, and you go in, if you get vaccinated, you're eligible for the raffle, you win the raffle, you get an iPad. These are the type of interesting things that are going to make a difference, and Dave can give you some of the ideas he's got to get some of our work sites of people vaccinated as well. So with that, let me hand it over to Chris, first of all. Tell us a little bit what you see in terms of the businesses and what type of ideas we can help you with and what they need to get all their employees vaccinated, Chris.
Yeah, thanks, Governor. Great to be with you and Dave again, just 2 days after that historic press conference around the unemployment trust fund reform. You know, Governor, you've been saying from the beginning, and we've been saying probably back all the way last summer, getting people vaccinated is critical to both the health crisis and the economic crisis that COVID has rained down on the state and the country. You know, at CBIA, we have about 5,000 members with close to 400,000 employees across our great state. And so we've been really trying to get the word out to get, you know, all those 400,000 employees vaccinated. And I can tell you, Governor, the response to the May 19th full reopening that you announced on Monday, people are very, very excited about that and are, I think, charged up and incentivized to get vaccinated. And so we want to see as many people vaccinated as possible to fully enjoy the May 19th full reopening. And I'm proud to report that certainly our businesses, our members are stepping up and will continue to step up by doing two things, Governor. They're educating and incentivizing their employees. On the education front, CBI has been working closely with Commissioner Gifford and the Department of Public Health on all the great materials we have out there so employers can educate their employees and the residents of Connecticut about the vaccination and what it means to them and their families and loved ones to get vaccinated and stay healthy. And as you mentioned, Governor, on the other side, the incentivizing, there's been some great creative ideas out there that we're hearing from the Connecticut business community. There's been that kind of the normal gift cards and bonuses for employees as they get vaccinated, pay time off for when you do get the shot and or maybe the day after in case you have any lasting effects, which seem to be, you know, few and far between. One company we talked to has a paid company lunch when they get to 80%. So when all across the company, they're 80% vaccinated, they're going to have a company lunch, kind of a celebrate that milestone. And then after that milestone, once the company gets to 100% vaccination, they're gonna shut down for the day. Everyone's gonna get a day off, which we really applaud the companies for doing. And as you had on your slide, a real fun and creative one has been the raffle idea that companies have started to kick around in the month of May and June, having a weekly raffle, whether it's the TV, yard goat tickets, something fun. And if you've been vaccinated and got both shots, you take a picture of your card and send it to HR. They put it in a box and pull it out, and the vaccinated employees are eligible for the raffle. So lots of fun, incentivizing, creative ideas going on, Governor. We have one member I want to just kind of shout out, Allnex in Wallingford, who's really been coordinating closely with the town of Wallingford and just recently surpassed the 80% vaccination milestone. And not a huge company, a small company, but doing a lot of great work. And working closely with the town and Department of Public Health. So there's things that can be done, whether you're a big company, a little company, a medium-sized company, to get your employees vaccinated. And CBI is here to help. I know, Governor, you're here to help, and labor is really pushing hard as well. So great things to come.
Yeah, no, thank you, Chris. We're thinking here in state government what we could do. Somebody said, hey, if you get vaccinated, you get to have lunch with the governor. Then somebody else said, if you don't get vaccinated, you got to have three lunches with the governor. So we'll do whatever it takes. Hey, Dave, how do we get guys at the work site vaccinated?
Oh, I got a lot of ideas for you, Governor. Nice to be with you and Chris again. So, you know, as president of the Connecticut State Building Trades, my first priority is keeping our construction workers safe. A construction site's already a dangerous place to be, and we rely on everybody to do their best to stay safe. If you get the shot, you can get back to your normal life. And most importantly, it keeps everyone around you safe. You might be worried about side effects. But don't forget how scary it's to actually get COVID. Business and labor from time to time tend to butt heads. Not always, but it happens. But we also know how to come together when we know what's best for the state and everyone who lives here. We did it a couple days ago talking about lifting up our unemployment insurance program. And today we're talking about a vaccine. Working together leads to results, and that's especially true when it comes to the vaccine. Governor Lamont, you've been talking about these workplace-based clinics and possibly promoting to get people paid time off to get vaccinated. With that being the case, I'll work with my union building trades affiliates to offer vaccine clinics at our union meetings, union halls, training centers, and job sites. I'll sweeten it up for you a little bit too, Governor, because I happen to be known for my slinging of hamburgers and hot dogs. You get me a vaccination site on a job site, and I'll supply the hot dogs and hamburgers and feed the guys. So let's go, Connecticut. Let's get vaccinated.
All right. I'll be there, Dave, as long as I don't have to have one of your hot dogs. Hey, thank you, guys. I really appreciate the work you do together and what you're doing on behalf of the state. With that, Josh and Paul, myself, here to take your questions. See you, guys.
Channel 3 Eyewitness News.
Yes, Governor, just wanted to see if people are keeping up with their second appointments. Are there stats available on that?
Josh, you have those numbers?
Yeah, there are. We were actually just looking at this earlier today. We've got 96% success rate on people getting their second dose, which for a two-dose vaccine regimen, I'm told is exceptionally high. I haven't seen a federal benchmark on that, but, you know, our providers have been doing a really great job following up with everybody who may be late on their first dose to make sure they get in for their second dose. So we're doing very well there.
Perfect. So what is the expectation for the percentage of fully vaccinated people in Connecticut?
Well, I'll start. 6 months ago, we saw 50% of the people had vaccine hesitancy. Not me. I'm going to wait. I don't want to do it. And I think you see that we're very close to 90% of the folks over the age of 75. We're not going to get there for the general population, I don't think. But I'd like to think that Connecticut will take the lead. And we continue to encourage our friends who maybe are hesitant to do it. And we make it easier for you to get vaccinated. I like to think we're going to get over 70%. You saw Israel began stalling out at about 60% fully vaccinated. Let's beat that.
Okay, so 70% is kind of the target for the state. And I know that you mentioned that by May 19th, 70% will get the first dose. Is there a date attached to the 70% for fully vaccinated?
No, I just sort of came up with that number. I'd like to see 100%. I see it works, it's safe, it's effective, it keeps your family safe, it keeps your work site safe, your fellow workers safe. I just made up a number. 70% is a place I thought we could get in the near term.
Thank you.
News 8.
Good afternoon, everyone. Governor, you touched on this, you know, around the country, and you mentioned Georgia. Georgia and just one of several states around the country where they're shutting down max vaccination sites. And I know that has to be surprising to you based on what we've done here. But the thinking outside the box and all the incentives and stuff, can you just talk a little bit more about that, maybe, you know, how that came about into this thinking to get creative and find more ways when maybe demand is down and supply is up? You wouldn't go to the closing any of the sites, would you?
I sure hope not. Look, I mean, Josh and Deirdre, we've been predicting sometime in the latter part of April, supply and demand are supply is outstripping demand. We've seen that in some of the southern states a couple of weeks earlier. We know that, you know, maybe younger people, the so-called invincibles, maybe don't feel quite the same urgency. And look, we're not into mandates, but we are into doing everything we can to encourage you and incent you to do the right thing. So we started having a little fun around the office and talking to business and labor, coming up with some incentives that work. And let's give it a try. Any businesses out there, we're all ears. We'll publicize what you don't want to do. Is it a free meal, a free baseball ticket? Let's go. Let's get people vaccinated.
Dr. Fauci predicted that maybe in the first quarter of 2022, by that point, kids of any age should be able to get vaccinated for the virus. As you look forward now, and obviously there's vaccinations that are required for many other things, have you already begun talks about next year, should that come to fruition? And do you have something in your mind? You mentioned you haven't mandated a lot. Is that something you would consider mandating, or is it way too early to talk about that?
Well, it's a little early because they don't even have the vaccines. You know, maybe they're in some early tests. I haven't heard that. 16 and above, we're hoping that 12 to 16 will be okay to, at some point in the near future. We're thinking a lot about universities because universities are congregate settings, residence halls. We've seen flare-ups at universities around the country, a lot less in Connecticut. And let's give a little time. If we can do this on a voluntary basis and the overwhelming majority of those folks get vaccinated on their own, that's the best solution.
NBC Connecticut.
Good afternoon, everyone. The Washington Post had an article today saying that the U.S. is seeing an unprecedented drop in vaccinations over the past week, declining 11%. I know you would said that we're seeing about 10% every week, and it seems like so far, based off of that graph, they're going well. But are you noticing any kind of trend in line with that? And then I know we talked about this a little bit Monday, but wanted to also know if you'd seen any clarity on the possible reason why.
Well, I'll start and then pass it over to Josh, which is my norm. I think we're doing a lot better than a lot of these other states. We are more likely to wear the mask. We're more likely to get vaccinated. There is a little more slack in the system, no question about it, this week compared to last week. But I'd like to think we still have pretty good momentum, and thousands of people are getting vaccinated every day. Josh, anything to add there?
No, that's exactly right. And as you mentioned earlier, Governor, you know, this is the point at which we forecasted, you know, a couple months ago that we'd start, or a month ago that we'd start to see supply outstrip demand. And here we are. That said, we still have great momentum in our vaccine program. We vaccinated over 40,000 people yesterday, over about 20,000 first dose, about 20,000 second doses. You know, we're still getting about 1,000 people 65 and above coming in every day to be vaccinated. So, you know, there's still very good momentum, but, you know, there's no question that we now are at the phase of this program where, you know, the demand is starting to ease a little bit. We are seeing that. We're seeing appointments readily available across the state. And, you know, our focus going forward has to be more outbound, right? The mobile units, the door-to-door campaigns, the bringing the vaccine directly to people, breaking down any remaining barriers, questions, concerns they have to get those vaccination rates up as high as possible in the coming weeks.
Leanne Ducat, we've had Leanne on before from the group Informed Choice CT. They were among the groups in Connecticut, and there are groups like this around the country who are saying, listen, let's maintain the religious exemption for folks who want to claim that not to get vaccines. We're not telling people whether to get vaccinated or not, or vaccinate their kids. But their effort to sway the House did not work. A couple of days ago, the House voting 90-53 to remove that exemption, starting not this coming school year, next school year. So it now moves on to the Senate. Leanne, hi. Hope you are well. What's your reaction, first of all, to the what's your reaction to the House vote from the other day?
Well, thank you for having me. My reaction is that it was expected. You know, there's no Democrats that have enough stones in this state to stand up to Matt Ritter. So I'm not surprised by it at all. It's very unfortunate, obviously, because we're just trying to maintain, you know, parental rights to choose in this state and keep the government out of that conversation or the decision making. But it was to be expected, unfortunately.
You did get, is there any solace that you got a bit of a grandfather clause put in there that folks who voted for the bill said, listen, we should at least do this for some families who might have a tough time handling this? Or do you agree with those who say that, Leanne, that the grandfather clause that's in the House bill makes it even more tough on some families?
The grandfathering is a mess all around. One, it has a sunset date, so children aren't, you know, it's going to run out eventually. Two, it proves that there is no public health emergency. Their argument has pivoted now, saying that they have to prevent a public health emergency, but that's not what they were saying before they were introducing grandfathering. So it's a lot of doublespeak coming from the majority of Democrats in the state house. That grandfathering segregates families. Grandfathering is a trap to get other legislators to warm up to voting for the bill. Grandfathering separates families within Connecticut, and it's a big mess, and it's definitely going to be challenged legally.
So before we get to that legal challenge, yeah, let me ask you now about the state Senate. Of course, the Senate districts are much bigger. Democrats have a cushion. They have better than a 2-to-1 cushion in the Senate. But do you think you have any shot at all to derail this in the Senate? Or is what you folks are going to do now, Leanne, is concentrate on the legal challenges?
You know, I'm not quite sure about how the Senate's going to go. Obviously, the Democrats do have a cushion, and, you know, most Democrats in this state don't have the guts to stand up to leadership that is obviously drunk and out of control with power. So I'm expecting it to probably not go in our favor, and am proactively preparing for a legal challenge. However, on Tuesday, we do have an enormous amount of people showing up to rally outside the Capitol to let them know that all these people are watching. And it's just the beginning of the groundswell of opposition that they're going to start to see.
I've done a little reading on the states in which this sort of bill, Leanne, has been challenged so far. And I believe they've all failed. Correct me if I'm wrong, or if there were any partial victories. But are you at all, positively thinking of why a challenge would work in this state or not?
Well, we actually have the benefit of a different legal structure than the other two states, California and New York, that did this. California and New York are very different than us. And we learned a lot along the way watching other states and what they have done without showing my hand too much. Our team of attorneys is very excited to challenge us legally because we feel that we have a very good shot here in Connecticut. And we're gonna go for it. We've already got a fundraiser that's raised quite a bit of money to go towards it. We have assembled a very, very experienced and talented team of attorneys, one of them who is winning lawsuits left and right against Governor Cuomo in New York about coronavirus shutdowns and things like that. He's gotten many businesses to reopen in attorney Jim Mermigas. He's a very, very strong litigator. We're very excited to have him on the team as well.
All right, Leanne, thank you. We'll keep up with this and let us know if and when anything else happens on this. We'll be happy to put you on and at least get your side of it. Leanne Ducat, thanks. Have a good weekend.
Thank you. Take care.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye. All right, folks, I'm not taking a position on this either way. The only thing I will say is there's no emergency here. So understand what the informed choice Connecticut people are saying as to why they want to maintain this option to at least claim a religious exemption. I think we all know that there are a lot of different reasons to use the religious exemption. It may not be a stated religious issue, but it's there. And then on the other side, there are people who favor this bill, including, I think, some Republicans who voted, not too many of them, but voted with Democrats in the House and said, listen, we should have this in place to be there just in case there is any sort of an outbreak here of a sort of disease. But again, the fascinating part about this, to me anyway, who had a son grow up and had every one of, in fact, I was talking to his mom the other day. I was correct in saying, I just wanted to check with her. My son had every one of his shots except one, which our pediatrician said it was the second part of a two-stage shot. And because he had spiked a little higher of a fever than normal to the first shot, one of our pediatricians, we had some really good ones along his upbringing, said, no, it's all right. That temperature shouldn't have gotten that high, so forget. And everything else was fine. So we'll see how this shakes out. The thing that's interesting that I find in this, and we heard this from legislators about this and other people talking about it, yes, there are, the story we're told is there are about 8,300 kids in the school system right now in Connecticut whose families took advantage of not, some of them are totally unvaccinated, others are just missing one or two shots. But the interesting fact here is that there are reportedly maybe as high as 20,000 students, mainly in urban areas, low-income urban areas, who are not vaccinated fully, may, you know, missing a shot or two or three, but are not counted in the stats that are brought up about this bill. Now, those people, obviously, from what I've been told, they're not using a religious exemption. So how do we deal with the additional 20,000 that may be out there due to, who knows, the families may not have a doctor, there could be parental neglect, there could be a fear of vaccinations from them, who knows?